Okay, so let's get started. I'm presuming things are on track with respect to the assignment. Okay, if you have questions, please email me. I will not be here physically tomorrow, but I will be online. So if you have questions tomorrow, I can answer them by email. I believe Vimal is around. So if you want to talk to him, that's fine. Okay, so let's continue where we left off last time. So we started a new topic on fault tolerance, and I gave a quick overview of why we care about fault tolerance and distributed systems. And there were two issues. One is since there were multiple processes participating in this distributed system, we didn't want the failure of any one process to bring down the whole system. Okay. And the presence of this multiple process allows you to do that by offloading responsibilities of any one process onto others if there is a failure. Okay. That was one issue. The second issue was that you should think of fault tolerance in such systems because the probability of a failure goes up with the number of components in the system. Okay. As n, which is the number of components, maybe hardware software processes, goes up, you will see increased failure. So when very large systems, failures are the common case. Some fraction of the components are always down, okay, for repair or maintenance. So you want the system as a whole to function without any problem. So that was the motivation. So today I will talk about how to get agreement in the presence of fault. We'll talk about reliable communication and distributed commit. If time permits, we will also look at failure recovery using checkpointing. Okay. So here is a simple figure that illustrates how we are going to achieve fault tolerance in any system. Okay. This shows you how to achieve fault tolerance in a digital circuit. Okay. And the basic idea always is to use redundancy. Okay, the way you will achieve fault tolerance is multiple components in your system are going to perform the same function, or there will be a backup component that will take over if the primary fails. So in all cases, there is going to be some form of redundancy that allows you to tolerate failures. Okay? If this was data replication, then you would have redundant copies of the data. So if a node fails or a disk fails, data remains available. If you're talking about services, then computation has to be replicated so that if some component fails, you will get some others can take over. Okay? The same concept is illustrated here. Okay? What is shown in the top figure there, which is labeled A, is a circuit with three components A, B, and C. Okay? This is not a fault tolerant circuit because if either A, B, or C fails, the circuit will not function. Okay. This would be a distributed, think of this as a distributed system with three components where there is no replication. So if any one component fails, the system as a whole goes down because all three components need to be part of the system and be up for the system to function. Okay. What is shown in the second figure is an instantiation of the same circuit, okay, using redundancy. So each of the component is replicated to avoid having any single point of failure. Okay. So what we want is no matter which component fails, you want the circuit to continue to function. Okay. And that's shown here. So there are three distinct copies of A1, A2, B and C. Okay. So what is done is each of them will do the computation. So if this is a circuit that takes one bit and sends one bit out, each of them performs the computation they are asked to do and they produce an output. And then you have to vote on the output to see which output to pick. Okay? And as you will see, it's important to have even the voter be replicated. Because if you have a single voter that just takes the output of these three and takes the majority and says that's the solution to whatever the input was, and if that voter fails, their circuit is going to go down. Okay? So all components have to be replicated, which is the components themselves as well as the voters. Okay? So the output of each of these is sent to each voter. And then the voter votes and then you basically feed that to the next stage. Okay? This is how this circuit works. So now you can see that if any one component in the system fails, the system as a whole is going to continue to function. So if A1 fails, that's okay because its output or it may produce garbage, it may stop working or it may produce garbage, but A2 and A3 will outvote it. Okay? So each voter, because it's doing majority, it has the inputs from all of these, will pick the right output and then forward it to the next day. Okay, so you can actually tolerate one failure in each stage in this circuit. Okay, not just one failure globally, but in one failure in each of the replicated components. Okay. So it's just a very simple example of how you can achieve, how you can use redundancy to tolerate failures. Okay. Any questions? So this is called TMR or triple modular redundancy in circuit design. Okay, it is expensive because the cost of your circuit has actually gone up threefold. Because you have three times the number of components. But you will achieve fault tolerance.
So there will be a trade-off in the speed, right?
Why would there be a problem with the speed? Unless the voter is actually going to impose overhead, where it there will be some minimal overhead of voting, that is true. But beyond that, I mean, just having three circuits, they are three independent circuits, they are all operating in parallel. So there won't be any issue because of this redundancy. Each of the voter, this is an additional phase, so your input has to actually go through this extra step before it goes to the next phase. That will cause some slowdown. Even in a distributed system, the same is true. Okay, each replicated component might produce an output and then you have to vote, so that there's a small overhead of the voting phase.
And then the voter has to wait for all three initial circuits to complete?
Yes, the voter does have to wait for all three initial circuits to complete.
The speed is the slowest.
Yes, so you will operate at the speed of the slowest. You're absolutely right, but if you design the system right, there won't be too much of an overhead. If this process is much faster than the other two, then you are going to not get any benefit of that extra speed. Okay. So that's the issue. So there will be an overhead. No question. Okay. So now we will use that as an example to sort of have a more detailed discussion of how to design a distributed systems where you can tolerate faults. So the basis, so we'll cast this problem in a more abstract setting rather than looking at specific instantiation. We will look at principles of how to go about doing this. So what are we trying to do really? Okay, when we talk about redundancy, we want a group of redundant processes to agree on the results of a computation. So we'll assume that you have a distributed system with n components. Okay, each component is doing a specific task. Okay, so then what we will assume is each of those components is replicated. Okay, for fault tolerance reasons. Okay. So every request is now sent to each of the components, each of the replicated components. They will all perform the computation, they will produce a result, and then you will have to agree on what is the correct result. Okay. And if some components fail, then you have to ensure that the remaining components can still produce the right result for the system as a whole. Okay. So this abstract problem of basically boils down to how should a set of replicated processes that perform a certain task agree on the results of a computation. Okay? Now it so happens that the answer to this question depends on what is the type of fault you are trying to survive. Okay? So let's assume that you want a system, regardless of the type of fault, you want a system to be K fault tolerant, which means it can survive K parallel faults in parallel, okay, simultaneous faults, okay, and yet function. Okay. Now, depending on what kind of faults you want, the number of components in the system will be different. Okay. So let's assume that the simplest kind of fault is what is called a crash failure. Okay. Here, either a process functions or it does not function. Okay. When it functions, it always produces the right results. Okay. And the only kind of failure that we want to tolerate here are crash failures, where if it basically can crash and stop functioning altogether. Okay? So here, in other words, processes fail and they fail silently. So if there's any failure, there's no output from that process. Okay? If you want to tolerate these kinds of faults, then it's clear that to tolerate k simultaneous faults, you need k plus 1 components. Okay? Because if your process is producing a result, we're assuming the result is correct. Okay? And if it's not producing a result, the process has crashed. So all you need to tolerate k faults is k plus 1, because if k of them fail, there's still one functioning, and that's going to produce the right result. Okay? This is the simplest kind of failure. There isn't much to do here. The voter is trivial because you're assuming that the output of a process is correct so long as the process is up. Okay? Now, that's just a very simple kind of failure. What you have in practice are more complex failures called Byzantine failures. Okay? Here you can have arbitrary kinds of problems. Okay? A process may stop functioning, Okay? Even when it is functioning, it may produce garbage. Okay? Because there may be bugs, there may be security attacks, so somebody may have hacked into a process and may be spewing out garbage. Okay? So these are called Byzantine faults. Okay? Now again we want to tolerate K faults, K Byzantine faults, which means K processes among your replicas can do arbitrary things. Sometimes they may produce correct results, sometimes they may produce garbage, sometimes they may produce no result. Okay? Regardless of what result they produce, we still want to get agreement on what is the result of some input that you have fed to these replicas. Okay? And the question is, how much redundancy do you need and what techniques can you use to handle Byzantine faults? Okay, that's what we are going to look at. Yes, question there.
So if you're doing like the same voting thing as before, you just need 2k plus 1. So you always have, you know, K fail over half of the processes, correct?
Okay. So here basically we have, there is a simple point being made that you may need 2k plus 1. Because if K of them produce garbage, the other 2k can output. So that's right. We'll look at this in just a moment. Okay, so we'll take it one step at a time. So we'll start with a very simple scenario. Okay. So it depends on where the failure is. So it may be that the failure is in the process itself, or the failure may be in the communication channel connecting the process to some other process. Okay. Either the process itself may be faulty or the channel may be faulty. So let's take the case where there is faulty channel. Okay. So you have perfect process with an unreliable channel. So channel or a network is Byzantine. You send a message, some arbitrary message comes out at the other end. Okay, sometimes the network transmits a message perfectly, meaning there is no problem. Okay, and sometimes some bits may get scrambled, okay, during transmission. This is an example of a Byzantine channel. Okay, so we don't know what is coming out of the channel, whether it is reliable or not. So in the simplest case, we'll assume that the processes are not failing, but the channel is faulty. The Byzantine fault lies in the channel. Okay, now we need, basically the problem is, let's, in the simplest case, we'll assume that the message is exactly one bit. Okay. You are sending a one bit message. The message is either 0 or a 1, and that message actually gets transmitted over the channel. Something comes out of the other end. You want to reach agreement on what the message is. Okay. So this may be the output that you are producing and you want to vote on it. Okay. So this problem has also been cast in a different light and is called also the two army problem. Okay. Same problem slightly stated differently. So think of the two armies waiting to attack a common enemy. Okay, so there, let's say there's an army that's waiting. There are two camps of this army, and then the generals of these two camps want to exchange a message to agree on what time to launch the attack. Okay, this could be a one-bit message saying 4 a.m. or something like this. Okay, so but we'll assume that the messenger that is being sent by one camp to another has to go through some hostile territory, and the messenger can be captured. Okay, message can be altered in transit because the enemy may actually plant a false message in order to confuse the two camps. Okay, same problem. I mean, the two perfect processes are two camps here. The messenger is basically an unreliable channel. Okay, so the question is, can the general reach agreement on what time to launch the attack? Okay, this is called a Byzantine general problem. This is where the notion of Byzantine fault actually, the term Byzantine comes from. Is the problem clear? What the problem is, there are two generals, they are trying to launch an attack on a common enemy. They want to exchange a message to decide on what time to launch the attack. The messenger goes through hostile territory. So you don't know when a message comes to you whether the message has been altered. Okay? And arbitrary things may happen if the message is altered. So you want to reach agreement. Question is, can you do this? Yes, we have something
there. Sometimes
if the message is altered randomly or altered maliciously. In the Byzantine scenario, arbitrary things may happen.
Like
yeah, it could be malicious, it could be random, it doesn't matter. Assume that when the message comes, you don't know whether it was the same message that was sent, and you could do arbitrary things to find out. Okay, so question is, can you reach agreement? Yes.
Well, I know like networking protocols, they usually send like a checksum. So basically, if the message doesn't add up to that value, then you know something must have changed until you say it's, you're not going to accept it.
Okay.
But you can also change the checksum if you're doing it maliciously.
So you do a checksum. So in this context, what you will do is your general will sign the message. Okay? But we are assuming that your enemy is Byzantine. Enemy can do arbitrary things. So in particular, the enemy can forge a signature. So in the context of the checksum, if you change the message, you could change the checksum. Because I have the message, I can change any bits in the message, the payload or the checksum. So the checksum can be made to match the message. I mean, the answer is right there, right? So it basically says two perfect processes can never reach agreement in the presence of an unreliable channel. If your channel is unreliable, okay, there's nothing you can do to guarantee that the message you are getting is genuine or not. Right? In the Byzantine general case, as I pointed out, you could sign the message, but your enemy could also forge the signature, change the message and forge the signature. In the case of a checksum, the same thing is true. Right? You change the payload and you compute a new checksum and you append it. You just say, oh, checksum matches the payload and the message is correct. That may not be true. Okay? So, this is the issue. That, I mean, if you just have an unreliable channel, you can never reach agreement because you cannot trust the message. You can do arbitrary things. You can say, here's a message, send me an acknowledgement and see if you can reach agreement. But that won't work because you may send a message, alter it and send back a perfect acknowledgement. Right, because the negative acknowledgement can be turned into positive acknowledgement. So this is the problem of Byzantine's general problem in the presence of unreliable channel. So that doesn't work. So now let's assume that the channel is at least reliable. We will not worry about the channel itself, but we will assume the processes are faulty. Yeah, so here we have two perfect processes. The communication channel was faulty. Now we'll switch the problem around. We'll assume that the channel is not the one at fault. Channel is perfectly reliable, but one of the processes is faulty. Okay, in the case of Byzantine general problem, we'll assume that there are n generals. In here there were two, now there are n. And some subset of them are traitors. Okay, so they may actually send incorrect messages just to confuse the other ones. Okay, because they actually are traitors and they want to help the enemy, not the other generals. Then the question is, can n generals reach agreement with a perfect channel where m out of n generals are traitors? Can do our Byzantine things. So we'll assume that messages, whatever is sent, is received as is. But you can say the traitors can send arbitrary messages to others to confuse. Okay, so here is a scenario or an example of a protocol that the generals could use. Okay, here we'll assume that there are four generals. Okay, one is, and we'll assume that one is Byzantine faulty. We know that it's three, but the generals don't know who is traitor. I mean, that's the whole problem. So now what can they do to figure out what time to launch the attack? Okay, here instead of figure it, I mean, let's assume they want to reach agreement on their troop strength, not what when to launch the attack. It doesn't matter what you are trying to agree on. But in this example, you are trying to send a message saying, I have these many soldiers. Okay? So this is a recursive algorithm. So it sort of works in multiple rounds. In each round, you will basically send out a message, broadcast a message to all other generals, and others will do the same thing. You will process the message and you will do something else, okay, in a subsequent round. Question is, after some number of iterations, can you all agree what the other generals are saying and also isolate the one that is sending garbage? Okay, you have to reach agreement, and to reach agreement you have to know which ones are the faulty processes. Okay, so here is the protocol. Okay, so we'll assume that each general here is going to send out its troop strength. Okay, and we'll assume that general 1 has 1 kilo soldiers and 2 has 2 kilo soldiers and so on. Okay, so 1 is going to send 1 to all of them, 2 is going to send 2, 4 is going to send 4, 3 is a faulty process, so it can send arbitrary things, can send the right message to some, an incorrect message to some others, but we don't care. Okay, so we'll assume that it sends X to 1, Y to 2 and Z to 4. Okay, and values of X, X, Y, Z are variables, which means the message could be arbitrary. They could all be identical, they could all be different, okay, they could all be identical and incorrect, doesn't matter. Okay, so we can assume those are arbitrary messages. Okay. So at the end of the first round, each general has sent out a message to everyone else and received a message from everyone else. Okay. So what happens? So 1 receives 1, 2, X and 4. I mean, it sends 1 to itself. 2 gets 1, 2, Y and 4 and so on. Okay. 3 actually gets 1, 2, 3 and 4. It knows what its troop strength is, but it's sending incorrect message. So at the end of this round, you will actually broadcast what you receive from everyone else to again to everyone. Okay? So in other words, one is going to send this message saying, I received one from myself, I received a message 2 from 2, I received X from 3 and I received 4 from 4. Okay? And so on. So everybody does the same thing. So this is what you receive at the end of the second round. Okay? So what does one receive? This is the message it receives from 2. This is the message it receives from 3, which is ABCD. Arbitrary stuff can come from 3. This is 1, 2, Z, 4 from 4. Okay? And that's what 2 receives and that's what 4 receives. Okay? Now looking at this, can you agree on something? Can these three generals who are not traitors agree on something? So if you just compare these messages, what does this tell you? It tells you that 1, 2 and 4 are basically sending the same message to everyone else and others are reporting that they got this message from 1, 2 and 4. Okay? The only thing that doesn't match, only column that doesn't match is 3. Okay? Because 3 could have sent arbitrary garbage. Okay? So you can agree at the end of this. Okay, is that clear? Now 3 may be pretending to be a traitor but may send the right message. In which case again there is agreement. Okay, if 3 is actually Byzantine faulty but functions correctly, that does not cause a problem. It's only when it malfunctions and sends out garbage, you can actually identify because this column is not going to match. Okay, this row may not match either. Yes, there's a question.
So 3 says 8 to everyone. So it gives a consistent value, but it's not the correct value because it wants to trick them thinking they have a larger army size or something.
Yes. So what happens if 3 sends an incorrect value to everyone?
Everyone agrees on that value.
Yes.
And they all have the false belief that 3 has an army of 8.
So what will happen? Sorry? Yes, so here all we are trying to do is reach agreement. Agreement is what messages are you sending to everyone else. Okay? And you can reach agreement on the message you are sending. Okay? How to verify the authenticity of that message is a different problem. Okay? So if you send 8 to everyone and you consistently send 8 to everyone, okay, you can agree that what 3 sent was 8. So you are agreeing what output did you produce. Okay. Now if you think of this as a computation rather than messages, so I feed the same input to all 4 processes and I produce an output. 3 may consistently produce the wrong output. It may produce an output of 8, but you will identify based on the output that everyone else has produced that that's an incorrect output. Okay. Is that clear what I just said? So if this was a result of a computation, not some arbitrary message you're sending, you could isolate 3 and say it produced the wrong output. So that's really what we want in the end. This is just an example. So this will allow you to reach agreement on what the output of a computation is. If everyone was trying to produce the same output, that you can do. Okay. Okay. So now let's do the Byzantine general problem, the same problem, but now there are only 3 generals and one is faulty, which is 3. Okay. So you will do the same process again. Okay, so 1 is going to send 1 to everyone, 2 sends 2, 3 sends garbage. Okay, so you get 1 to X, 1 to Y, 1 to 3. Okay, at the end of the second round, you will each broadcast what you receive to everyone else. Okay, so now you have 1 to Y and ABC. Okay, that's what 1 receives. And 2 receives 1 to X and DEF. Okay, what can you infer from this? Only 3 is sending different messages. So you know that this is not matching. So 3 could have sent arbitrary things to confuse you. Okay, yes.
You could do another round where they sent what they received back and they say, oh, so we both agree that we sent each other 1 and 2 to each other.
Okay, so you could do another round. Okay, remember that 1 doesn't know which process is faulty. It knows that it is not faulty. It's not a traitor, but it doesn't know whether 2 is traitor or the 3 is a traitor. The objective of the protocol is to identify that and also get the correct output. Let me provide a slightly different intuition. Let's assume that you have 2 friends. And let's assume that one of them is lying to you, but you don't know which one. So, and you can test them by basically asking them to say something, and then you can compare their answers. Now, if you don't know which of the 2 is lying to you, you know that you don't lie. Let's assume that. You don't know which of those 2 is lying to you, you will never be able to distinguish, depending on what they are telling you. That is the same problem you have here. One knows it's not faulty. It knows that one of 2 and 3 is faulty, but it doesn't know which one. Based on what they are sending it, it cannot distinguish which of them is right and which of them is not. That's exactly the problem here. So in the previous case, at least this was agreeing. I mean, the 1, 2 and 4 were always producing 1, 2 and 4. So they could actually compare these and say, okay, at least these 2 are agreeing with me. In particular, 1 knows that 2 and 4 are agreeing and 3 is the one that's not agreeing. So it can isolate. So if you have 3 friends and only 2, one of them lies and the other 2 produce the right result, you send them, ask them something, 2 of them answer the same thing and the third one does not, you know who is the liar. That's the same issue here. But if you have only 2, you cannot distinguish who is lying and who is not, because they will disagree, but you cannot break the tie as to who is right and who is wrong is not known to you. Is that clear? So basically, because of this, you have a property which says that in this case you will not be able to isolate the faulty process. So what this also says is the amount of redundancy you need in the system is you need 2/3 of the processes to function correctly. So in other words, if you want to tolerate k faults or m faults in this case, this is only possible if at least 2m plus 1 processes function correctly out of 3m plus 1. So to tolerate, in other words, if m equals 1, you want to tolerate one faulty process, which was the example we saw here, you need at least 3 correctly functioning processes out of 4. If you had only 2 out of 3, you cannot distinguish when you have Byzantine failures who is right and who is wrong. You can do crash failures, because crash failure just says as if there is a faulty process, it just stops responding. So then you know. But if they are producing garbage, you cannot distinguish garbage from correct results. That's the problem. So, as I said, if you are just dealing with crash failures, you only need 2k plus 1, which is what we just said, looked at earlier. But if you want agreement, then you need 2/3 majority. So this says that Byzantine faults, it requires a high amount of redundancy in your system. 2/3 majority. To tolerate a single fault, you need 4 processes. That's a high amount of redundancy. Single Byzantine fault, you need 4 copies of every data item. So as you can see, that's much harder. I mean, harder as in much more expensive. Not hard, but expensive. Now, because of this, all the Byzantine faults are actually common. Because of this high amount of redundancy, many practical systems do not choose to implement this high degree of redundancy. They assume a simpler fault model, saying, let's assume that processes just crash. And things, so for the simpler model, you don't need that high degree of redundancy. But if you really wanted to tolerate Byzantine faults, you would need 3k plus 1 processes. This is something to keep in mind. So there's some extra material on Byzantine fault tolerance, but I will not present that here. Let me just skip this and just ask if there are questions on Byzantine fault tolerance before I move on. Is the problem clear, right? What is Byzantine general's problem and what is the key result in terms of the amount of redundancy you need to tolerate Byzantine faults? Okay, so now I'm going to talk about, we'll go back to the communication issue. Okay, we are talking about processes and communication. We looked at processes, now let's come back to communication. Okay, So if you remember back when we were doing this RPC material, we looked at failures in the context of RPC. Okay, so I presented several techniques where if you have a RPC mechanism with a client server model and arbitrary messages get lost, then how should the system recover? Okay, so in particular we looked at lost request messages, lost reply messages, server crashing after it receives a request, client crashing after it has sent the request. Okay. So we looked at all of this material. Okay. It was presented back in lecture 3 in the current version of the book, which is the second edition. That material has actually moved from communication chapter to a fault tolerance chapter. Although I presented it there, okay, when you look review the material for your exam, you'll see that the material I presented in lecture 3 is not in that chapter, is actually here. Okay, so I just want to have this placeholder slide so you know where the material is in the book. Okay, so I'm not going to review this again. Okay, we have already done this, but I wanted to put in this backward pointer. Okay, but instead what I will talk about is reliable one-to-many communication, not one-to-one communication. So here the problem is as follows. You have one-to-many communication which says there's a sender and there are multiple receivers. Okay? And this is called multicast. Typically, if you are sending a message to multiple receivers that receive it, you do what is called multicast communication. Okay? And the issue is if the sender is sending messages and some subset of the receivers receive the message, but not all, then how do you deal with lost messages in your system? Okay? In the simple one-to-one case, if you have things like protocols like TCP, any lost messages are recovered by sending acknowledgement so you know what the receiver has received and what the receiver has not received. So you will buffer messages and retransmit, okay, based on what acknowledgements you are seeing from the receiver. You could do the same thing here. Okay, so in the simplest case, you send each message as the messages are numbered. So in this case, you are sending out message number 25. Okay, and if everyone receives it correctly, you send an acknowledgement. Okay? But if you miss a message, okay, and you receive a message that sort of, so here you have a scenario where receiver 1, 2 and 4 have received message 24 and then they receive 25, so everything is coming in order. This receiver actually is a saw 23, it missed 24 and now it got 25. Okay, so now it knows that you have missed a message, okay, because there is a message in between, sequence number 24 you haven't received. So what would you do? So you could actually send all this. So this one sends an acknowledgement to 25, you send an acknowledgement to 25, you send a message saying I missed 24, okay, and then you send an ACK 25. So now the sender knows that three receivers have received all of their messages so far, but one has actually missed 24. Okay, so then you can buffer message 24 and send it back, okay, to this receiver. This is a simple extension of using acknowledgements, okay, to retransmit messages and recover lost messages from the network. Now the problem with this approach is it will not scale with the number of receivers. Okay, if you are doing a multicast to, let's say here you only have 4 receivers, let's say you have 100, okay, or 1000 or 10,000, okay, what is going to happen at the sender end? You might have to deal with lost messages and you have to deal with an increasing number of acknowledgements. Okay, if you have 10,000 receivers, every message you send causes 10,000 messages to come back to you, okay, potentially. Okay, so the sender has to do more and more work to process all of these acknowledgements. Okay, so what this says is a simple ACK-based scheme does not scale with the number of receivers in multicast communication. Okay. And this number 10,000 is not made up. If you actually have live webcasts of event, you might have 10,000 people on the internet listening to the live webcast. Every time you send a packet, if they all send messages back, the server has to deal with all of this extra overhead. In one-to-one, this is not a problem because you're getting one acknowledgement for each message. Here you're getting n acknowledgements for each message. Okay. So in ACK-based scheme, the sender can become a bottleneck as the number of receivers grows. So what people have designed instead is NAC-based scheme. Now, NAC stands for a negative acknowledgement. Okay? A negative acknowledgement says that only reply to the server if you have not received a message. If so long as you are receiving all the messages without losing any in between, don't even bother telling the server or the sender. Sender will assume things are fine. So this, in the same scenario, what would happen now is this receiver Okay. So long as these other receivers are receiving all of the messages in order, they don't send any acknowledgement to the server. Okay. When some receiver misses a message, in particular this one, it sends out a NAC. Okay, saying I missed. So it will still send this message. Okay, but these are suppressed. So this is called ACK suppression. The suppressed ACK only send this message out. Okay, this is called a NAC saying I missed this. Okay, in this particular case, you can broadcast it to not only the sender, but all other receivers who are close to you. So if any one of them has it buffered, they can send you the missed message. Okay. So you don't have to broadcast, but that just reduces the burden on the server even further. So you could just ask locally saying, do you have this message buffered? None of the receivers have it, then you can go back to the sender and say, please resend this message. So somebody needs to retransmit. Okay, you are just trying to optimize the scheme so that the sender doesn't have to always retransmit, someone else has it. Now this reduces the number of messages the sender has to process. So for every message, you are only receiving messages where someone has not received that message. Okay, so if you have generally reliable channel, then the number of NACs that come back to you should be significantly smaller than the number of ACKs. If you have a very lossy channel, then the number of NACs is going to be very high. Okay? But in that case, you have to do the extra work in any case to retransmit. So it's not wasted message. ACKs are just wasted because you don't have to do anything. NACs, you have to do something. So that overhead is okay. Yes, you have a question.
How is the receiver distinguishing the message sent and is not received and the sender is not actually sending any message?
You're
saying about negative.
Okay. So that's a good question. How does the receiver know that you have missed the message? You will never know that you missed a message until you received a subsequent message that allows you to figure out that you missed something. Okay? If you are sending 25 messages, you received 24, you didn't receive the 25th and there is no 26th message, you will not know this. Okay? The only way you will know is if you missed a message. So this is a good example. Okay, this receiver did not receive message 24. It doesn't know that until it actually receives the next message, which is 25. Then it knows that the last message is 23, now I have received 25, so there is a missing message in between. This is the only way you will know. Okay, otherwise, you will not know. Yes, question.
If you have like a last message, everyone knows like message 100 last one.
Yes. So there is a solution to the example I just made up. Which is, if this is the last message, then before you tear down the connection, you say, I have sent so many messages. So if somebody did not receive the last one, they'll send a NAC. Okay, there's always the tear down message for the connection. So that problem is addressed by this extra dummy message. That's the same thing you are saying. Okay, but in general, you will not know that you missed a message until the sender actually sends one after that you do receive. Is that clear? Okay. So that was simple multicast, and how do you use negative acknowledgments to do multicast. Now we'll look at a stricter form of multicast, which is called atomic multicast. In atomic multicast, you want a guarantee that either all processes receive the message or no process receives that message. Okay, it's all or nothing. So you want to do multicast, but you want an atomicity guarantee. Saying if I do a send, either everyone in the group should receive it, multicast group, or no one should receive it. Okay? And this kind of property is useful whenever you have replication. So in a replicated database, or if you go back to the consistency discussion we just had in the last class, I said every time there is an update, you have to broadcast this to all the other replicas so that they are all up to date. Okay? So you do want a property where this broadcast update is received by everyone or no one. If some of them receive it and some don't, and some replicas are consistent and others are not, and you don't know who is consistent and who is not. Same is true in the database. If you want to provide strict ACID properties, okay, if you have a replicated or a distributed database, every update has to be propagated to everyone, okay, or none or no one, so you can actually give transactional semantics. So then the question is, so all this is saying is there are scenarios where trying to guarantee atomicity in the multicast communication is useful. Now the question is, how do you do it? Okay. So typically the way this is done is using this notion of a group view and group changes. So what happens in this scenario is each process keeps track of who are all the processes that are alive. Okay. And the assumption here is that the channel is reliable And the only way some process does not receive a message is if the process crashes. This could be the sender may crash in the midst of sending messages, or it could be a receiver where the receiver received a message and crashed. So if the message channel is reliable, but processes crash, then the question of ensuring atomicity boils down to detecting when a crash has occurred. So in particular, if the crash has occurred in the midst of sending a message, you want to check whether this crash caused some subset of the processes to not receive the message. And if you detect that, then you undo and basically you say nobody has received the message. But if everyone did receive the message, the process crashed just after this message actually reached it and everyone else also reached it, you are still okay because you are guaranteed atomicity. Okay, is that clear what I just said? So in other words, what you want is to keep track of what is the group that can see each of the messages that are being sent. So here is a figure that shows that this P2 is sending out a message to a group of four processes, P1 through P4, and this message is received by everyone. This is fine, this is atomic. And there's another message that goes out here from P1 to everyone. That is also fine. Okay? And here is another example where P3 is sending out a message. Okay? So in this case, what happens is P3 sends out a message, and that message gets to P2 and P4, but before it sends a message to P1, okay, multicast the message out to P1, it crashes. Okay. So this is not a desirable scenario from an atomic multicast perspective. So what you would rather want is to have either P2 or P4 redeliver the message, okay, to P1, okay, because P3 has crashed, that's what is shown here. Or you don't want this message to everybody, should throw away the message. So you want one of these two things. Okay, either have the ones who have received it redeliver it to the ones who have not because the sender has crashed, or everyone agrees that the sender crashed, so let's all discard the message. Okay, so it looks like nobody received it. We want one of these two properties. Okay. And the question is, how do you agree on this? How do you know that there's a crash and so on? Okay. So there is a scheme called virtually synchronous multicast that has been designed to ensure this. Okay, so what happens here is this is sort of showing the same the approach in a slightly simpler fashion. So here you have eight processes. Okay. We'll assume that process 7 crashes. Okay. If somebody notices that a process has crashed, you send a message called view change message. Okay, saying 7 has crashed. If any of you have received a message from 7, okay, please send it. So what this causes is all these other processes, okay, that might have received a recent message from 7 and have buffered it, will flush that message to everyone else, saying here is a message that I received from 7. Okay. So in particular, in this case, what would happen is if P3 crashes, some process can say P3 crashed. So if you received a message from P3, please resend. Okay. So if any one of these processes received this message, okay, that process can respond by saying, here is the message that was sent. Okay, by this, you basically ensure that it gets redelivered to everyone else. So now everyone has received the message and you are fine. Okay, is that clear? So that's essentially what happens. So there are these flush messages that go out, which say, here are all the messages that were received, okay, while 7 may have crashed in this particular case. This is the basic concept of virtual synchrony. Okay. Now, this was a fairly large distributed system that was built back in the 90s, okay, called ISIS, that implemented virtual synchrony. The book actually has a lot more details of how ISIS works, and in particular how the notion of virtual synchrony is implemented in ISIS. As far as the course is concerned, we will not look at the details of ISIS. If you are interested, go and read it. All that we care about here is how do you ensure this notion of atomicity in multicast, and why is that important, and what is the basic concept behind how you can guarantee that even though a process may have crashed in the midst of sending messages, whether everybody received it or not. Yeah, that's the point we want to deal with here. Okay, so now, throughout the course, we have talked about multicast at various different points. Okay, you may remember that we had totally ordered multicast when we were doing Lamport's clock, then we did causally ordered multicast and so on. So this is a table that summarizes various types of multicast and what type of ordering they give you and whether it is totally ordered or not. Okay. So here you have three generic forms of multicast. One is reliable, okay, that's the NAC based scheme that we talked about. Okay. One is FIFO and then there is a causal. And the multicast scheme becomes stricter as it goes down. Okay. Reliable just says that whatever you send is received. Okay. But it doesn't guarantee anything about ordering. The things may get out of order, but so long as every message that is sent is received, then that's reliable communication. Okay. FIFO multicast says that not only is it reliable, but it also delivering anything you have, any one process has sent in FIFO order. Causal multicast is even stricter, which says that when two arbitrary processes multicast arbitrary messages, if there's a causal dependence between them, then the delivery should also respect causal properties. Meaning, if send of a message M occurred before send of N, then the delivery of M should have occurred before delivery of N. So we looked at this when we did vector clocks, if you remember. Okay. So you get stricter properties as you go down. This is just doing reliability, no ordering. This is doing ordering within a process. This is doing ordering across processes so long as there is causality between them. If there is no causality, no ordering is guaranteed. Okay. Those are these three properties. Here you start with atomic multicast. Okay. It just says all or nothing, but doesn't guarantee any ordering. Okay. So you may receive things out of order, but either everybody receives a message or no one receives it, but concurrent messages can be received out of order. Okay. Then you can make it one step stricter by saying you have FIFO atomic multicast, which says not only is it atomic, but any within a process you are sending and receiving things in FIFO order. So if process P1 multicast message M and then message N, and everybody receives M and then they receive N. Okay, because within a process things are FIFO. Okay. And then again, the more stricter one is causal atomic multicast, okay, which ensures causally ordered delivery. So it says that you are not only guaranteeing atomicity, but across processes when they send, if there's causal dependence, the receipt of those messages also are causal dependent. So you can have these various flavors of multicast. Okay. So we have only seen some of point solutions, not all of these. But it's important to keep in mind that you can have these different combinations of whether you have a multicast, whether it's atomic or not, whether it's FIFO, and whether you have causal, respecting causal properties in the system. Okay. And it turns out that ISIS, actually the system that I was just talking about, implements all of these properties. Okay. When you say you want to send this, open a channel and want to do multicast, you can specify any of these, saying I want this version of multicast of that, and it has the implementation to do any of those. So that's something to keep in mind. Now, I haven't shown you how to do it in ISIS. We only looked at, in particular, just this scheme. Okay, but just keep in mind that ISIS can actually do any of those things. Okay. So, the last thing we will talk about today is the notion of distributed commit. Okay. This is a straightforward generalization of atomic multicast. Okay, so, atomic multicast was this all or nothing problem. Either all members of a group receive a message or no member of a group receives a message. Okay. So rather than receiving a message, if you just generalize this to all processes in a group perform an operation, okay, an arbitrary operation, okay, or none at all, you have this notion of the algorithm that does that is called distributed commit. Okay. In atomic multicast, this operation was the sending of a message. Yes, either everybody receives it or nobody at all. But instead of send, you can think of an arbitrary operation. Everybody agrees to do something or nobody does something. Okay. Now, this is called distributed commit. Okay. Now, we looked at this very briefly. We didn't see how to do it. But when I talked about distributed transactions, I said there is this commit operation at the end. And I said when we look at the next chapter, okay, we'll come back to see how you will actually do the commit. Okay. So, in the particular, in a transactional system, what the processes are agreeing to is either to commit the transaction or not. So, if you have a read-write conflict or a write-write conflict, you want to abort the transaction. So, all replicas need to agree that you want to abort. Okay? Or if there is no conflict, everyone agrees that you want to commit that transaction. That's the operation you do in a transactional system. So, all processes are replicas of the database, and the operation that they are trying to agree is whether to commit a transaction or abort the transaction. For transaction or asset semantics, everybody has to do the same thing. You can't have some replicas committing a transaction and some aborting, and you will violate asset properties. Okay. So now we'll look at how to do this. Okay. So there are two techniques we'll look at. One is called two-phase commit, okay, or 2PC, and the other is called three-phase commit. Okay. Don't confuse two-phase commit with two-phase locks. Okay. We did look at two-phase locking in a distributed transactional system. That was what order do you get locks and what order do you release locks. Commit is what happens at the end of the transaction. Should we all agree to commit or should we agree to abort? Okay, they have similar sounding names, but they do completely different things. So let's start with two-phase commit. The protocol actually is very simple. Okay, you are going to use voting to decide what to do. So how are a group of processes going to decide on whether to commit or not? You pick a coordinator. Coordinator asks everyone, should we commit this transaction? Okay, everyone responds with saying yes or no. Okay. Everyone says yes, let's commit, then you go ahead and commit. If anyone says no, that's like a veto, saying if somebody wants to abort, then everybody has to abort. You can't have some committee, but to commit, everybody has to say commit. To abort, at least one has to vote for abort. Okay. Simple voting protocol. Okay. So as I said, there's a coordinator. You can pick one of the processes to be the coordinator, and at the end of each transaction it will ask all replicas saying should we commit or abort, and everybody votes, and the coordinator looks at the vote and sends back a result saying the end result of voting is to commit. Everybody commits. Somebody votes to abort, then you send out a message saying please abort, and everybody aborts the transaction. Okay. That's basically what is shown here. You send out a request initially saying what should we do, get all the responses, then send back a response saying commit or abort, and everybody acknowledges. This is very simple two-phase commit. Yeah, so at this level, it seems trivial and easy to understand. Is there any question on this? What the technique is? So now let's go and try to understand whether it actually works. Because this, as we said, this should work regardless of failures. Yes, because that's the whole point. We are trying to do fault tolerance. So we can assume that arbitrary things can happen. Okay? A process or the coordinator can fail at arbitrary points in time. Okay? And you still don't want a scenario where some processes commit and some abort. That's what we are trying to avoid. Even in the presence of some replicas going down, you want everybody to reach the same state. Everybody either aborts or commits, regardless of what happens while this voting is taking place.
Do you have Byzantine results, like where they send commit or abort when they actually...
You could send anything. It doesn't matter what. We are not asking the question whether you are voting to commit or abort based on what actually happened during the transaction. You vote any way you want, and you can force everyone to abort by sending an abort even when you wanted to commit. That's not important.
When only you abort and you say commit, to, then everyone might commit, but you aborted.
Okay, so we will not do that. We will not say that you would vote for something and do something else. Okay? That we will not do, but we will just want to tolerate process failures. Yeah, that's it. So if a replica crashes while it is in the midst of voting, or the coordinator crashes, you don't want an inconsistent state where some of them have committed, some have aborted. So in that sense, it's more tolerating crashes rather than voting for something and doing something else. So let's assume that's not happening here. So here is a simple state transition diagram of what happens at the coordinator and what happens at each of the processes. So you have four states: init, wait, abort, and commit. This is phase one where the voting is taking place. And this is phase two where, based on the results of a vote, you either go and do a commit or an abort. Okay. So here you basically send out a vote request to everyone, okay, saying vote on this. And if anyone votes for an abort, you send out a global abort message to everyone. If everyone votes to commit, you send a global commit. This is what the coordinator is doing. Okay. This is what each of the replicas are doing. Okay. They are in the init state. When you receive a vote request, and if you this vote to abort, then you can straight away go and abort because you know the coordinator is going to ask everyone to abort. Okay? If on the other hand you want to commit, then you have to wait to hear back from the coordinator because you don't know what others have voted. So you wait for the coordinator to tell you. You are willing to commit. Okay? But whether actually commit or not depends on what others also vote. Okay? So you go into this ready state waiting to hear back on the results of the vote. Okay? The results of the vote are to abort, which is somebody voted to abort, you send an acknowledgement and you abort. If the results are to commit, send an acknowledgement and you commit. Okay? This is a state machine representation of the simple protocol that we just talked about. Okay? And we are going to use the state machine representation to analyze what might happen if you are in a certain state and someone crashes in the system. The basic property you want is, regardless of what state anyone is in, if some process crashes, okay, you still want everyone to just reach one state, one of these two states. It doesn't matter which one, you just want one consistent state based on the results of the vote. Your question?
Oh, I'm not.
Okay. So, now let's try to do some analysis. Okay, so anyone can fail, coordinator can fail, process can fail. So let's assume that the coordinator sends out let's start with something simple. Let's assume that you are in the init state, okay, and you crash before you vote on something. Okay. So if you haven't even voted, okay, what should the coordinator do? Coordinator broadcast vote request to everyone. Okay. 9 out of 10 processes responded, one crashed, did not respond. Okay. So the safe thing for the coordinator to do is, let's abort the transaction, okay, and it will cause the other 9 to abort. Okay. When the 10th one comes back up at some later point in time, it will still be in the init state. It checks with the coordinator. Coordinator says it was aborted, so you abort. Okay. The reason you shouldn't commit, okay, you know, you could have said, if 9 out of 10 have responded and all 9 have agreed to commit, why shouldn't we commit? Yes.
Because if it crashed, it might never be back up until by default aborting, you couldn't submit it.
Yes. So the reason, even if 9 out of 10 respond and all 9 say you should commit, the coordinator should still abort, is because the 10th one did not vote. When it comes back up and it says, I got a write-read conflict, so you should have really aborted the transaction, and then the other 9 have committed, you have violated asset property. So it's safer to abort rather than commit. Okay? Even if the 10th one wanted to commit and didn't vote, aborting is a safe thing. It will not violate any properties because everyone can redo the transaction. But if you go ahead and commit and the 10th one comes back and says, no, there was a conflict, then you have done something that you shouldn't have done. Okay? So in any case, so issue is, if you are in the init phase, you don't even vote at all, there's a safe thing to do. The coordinator says abort, not everyone has voted, you abort. Okay? Now let's suppose that you are in the ready state. You actually voted on something and you are in the ready state and you never hear back from the coordinator. Now we'll assume coordinator has crashed. Okay, what should you do?
New coordinator?
You could elect a new coordinator, that's right, but I mean you have to figure out what happened to this vote. So you can check with some other processes saying, did you hear back from the coordinator? Okay. If some process has heard from the coordinator, but not all, and that process, then that means that the coordinator has actually received votes from everyone, and it sent out the results of the vote, but it crashed while it was doing that. That's why some processes heard on the results of the vote, but not others. Okay? And if you can ask, so you can ask the process that heard from the coordinator saying, what was the end outcome of the vote? The outcome was to abort, it's safe for you to abort. The outcome was to commit, it's safe for you to commit.
If you trust the
process. So here we'll assume that processes are just crash fault tolerant. Okay, so we'll assume whatever you hear back you can trust, not Byzantine fault tolerant. Okay. And this is okay because you know that if a process has actually heard from the coordinator, that everybody did what, that's guaranteed. There's no way for the coordinator to have sent out the results if somebody had not voted. Okay. So everybody voted. Okay. And the coordinator made a decision. Okay. And some process knows of the decision, so it can tell the others and others can do the same thing. So you can actually still end up in a safe state. Okay. Now the problem arises if you are in the ready state and you actually did not, nobody has heard from the coordinator. So everybody voted, okay. Coordinator crashed before it sent out the results of the vote. In the previous case, you are in ready, but some people actually heard on the results. What if nobody heard? So everybody voted, but nobody heard the results of the vote. So in this case, it turns out that you will actually have to block. You cannot make a decision without the coordinate. Remember that the coordinator is also a replica. It has two roles. It is a replica and it also is playing the role of the coordinator. So it's when the coordinator crashes, the replica crashes and the coordinator itself crashes. Okay, so now what you do, basically what happens is a replica has gone down and the replica is also the coordinator. So the coordinator is also down. Everyone has voted. You don't know what the results of the vote are. You cannot decide between the remaining replicas and make a decision. Okay, because you don't know how the coordinator itself would have voted. Okay, so you are stuck essentially. Okay, now question you can ask is why not abort? Why isn't that the right thing to do? Yes.
So the coordinator could have said the actual commit just never sends that message and commit itself.
Yes. The problem is because the coordinator is also a replica, okay, it may have told itself what to do. It hasn't told anyone else. So it basically got the results of the vote. Maybe everybody said commit. It decided to commit. It committed the transaction. But before it sent out the results of the vote to everyone else, it crashed. So if these guys say, okay, coordinator is down, let's abort it, and they go and abort, the coordinator comes back up, one replica is in commit state, everyone else is in abort state. Again, you are in an inconsistent state. So you cannot make this decision. So in the init state, you can make this decision because voting may not even have taken place. You did not even vote, so the coordinator can abort. If the coordinator fails, and you have voted on it, you cannot just go ahead and abort. This is a problem. Okay. So two-phase commit is also called blocking commit for this reason. Okay. In other words, all replicas will be blocked forever until the coordinator comes back up. Okay. They cannot make a decision without the coordinator. If the coordinator crashes in the midst of a vote and does not tell someone what the outcome of the vote was, because it could have told itself, but not anyone else. Okay. Yes.
Can you make
like
a protocol so that it has to send out a message
to everyone
else before it
does
itself?
Yes. Yes. So question is, can you modify this protocol so it actually has to tell someone before it does something? Okay. That is exactly what three-phase commit is. That's the next version of this protocol. Okay. So this is blocking. So here is some pseudo code. I'm not going to go into it in detail. This just shows how you will implement it. Okay. So you will see multiple phases. This is the voting phase. This is the decision of the voting. This is the coordinator. So it multicasts a vote request message to participants while your votes are still coming in. You count. Okay. If somebody says abort, just send abort. Okay. If everyone says commit and you also vote commit because you are also a replica. Yeah, so you also get to vote. So if everybody does commit, then you send commit. Okay, and then otherwise you write a number. So very simple pseudo code. I'm not going to yes your question here.
So what if the participant crashes after it sent a commit message but hasn't committed yet? So in the ready state it sent a commit message but it then crashed.
So question is, what if the participant crashes after it sent a commit message? Okay. So if you actually voted and you crash, the coordinator would have, in this case, received all the results of a vote. So it will do whatever the election tells it to do. Okay? So all other participants will go into some state and the consistency. And then when this comes up, it can just check with the coordinator what was the outcome of the vote. Okay, if you voted commit but somebody else had voted abort, the coordinator would have aborted. You are still in the ready state, you can safely transition. Okay? And if everybody voted commit, you can commit. You will not have an inconsistency, okay, because you have not actually, you just voted and you crashed before you got the results of the votes. When you come back up, you just ask someone or the coordinator what the outcome was and you make the transition that everyone else has made. So this is a simple case. It doesn't actually lead to any problems. Okay. Okay, so I just explained all of this saying if you are in the ready, you contact someone else and depending on what they did, you can decide. Okay, so we did all this. So now let's come back to this suggestion that was made as to how can you avoid this permanent blocking. So the issue is you want to still make a decision even if the coordinator has crashed. Okay, you don't want to block forever. So can you do that? Okay, so to do this, you add an extra step which prevents you from committing after the results of a vote, but you actually hold yourself in a what is called a pre-commit state. You wait to make sure everybody has actually heard on the results of vote, only then do you go and commit. So the same protocol now, okay? But there are three steps. In the first step, the coordinator asks vote whether she should abort or commit. Everybody votes. Okay? If somebody votes to abort, you just send out a message saying everybody should abort. If everybody agrees to commit, then you send out a message saying everybody has agreed to commit, please acknowledge this message. Okay? So then everybody acknowledges. Then you have one more step saying everybody has agreed to commit and everybody has acknowledged that everyone else has agreed to commit. And now please go ahead and commit. Okay? So you do this commit in two phases. You tell everyone that this is the result of the vote, but don't commit it. Just acknowledge that you got the results. And once you got the results, then you send saying everybody has gotten the result. Now you go ahead and vote. Okay? So now if you go back to that previous problem where I said you are in the ready state. Okay? If everybody is in the ready state, okay, and you don't hear back on the results of a vote, what can you do? In the previous case, you couldn't do anything without the coordinator. Okay? So now these other processes can decide amongst themselves and do something. Okay? Because the worst that could have happened is the coordinator has itself put itself into a pre-commit state and then crashed without sending the results of the vote. Okay? So it hasn't yet committed. So there's still a safety switch which says if the rest decide to abort or commit, then the coordinator comes back up, it can do the same as everyone else. Okay, in the previous case, it would have actually already committed. So there's no undoing after you're committed. Here you're still in the pre-commit state. Okay? So the others can decide without you. In particular, they can elect a new coordinator. This new coordinator can take over and decide something. And when the old coordinator comes back up, it can be no further than the pre-commit state. Okay, it can ask someone else saying what happened and do the same thing. Okay, is this clear how you have avoided the problem of the same suggestion that was made saying let's not go directly to commit, let's just agree that we have committed and then take the next step. Okay, so this allows you to back out if someone crashes. The rest of the failure cases are still the same. Okay? If you are in it and you crashed, you did not even vote, the coordinator can decide to put you in abort after a timeout. Okay? If you are in ready and the decision was made, you voted but you didn't hear back and you crashed, when you come back up you can ask someone and do whatever someone did, what the results of the vote were. So all of those are still the same. It's the scenarios that we mentioned. The only problem was when you voted and you haven't heard back from the coordinator. Okay? Now in this case, no one else has also heard from the coordinator. That was the problem case in two-phase commit. In this case, the rest can make a decision because the worst that the coordinator could have done is gotten the results of the vote and done something. So yes, question.
What if everyone sends a pre-commit message to the coordinator and the coordinator crashes but could have committed then?
I'm sorry, what's the question?
If everyone sends a pre-commit to the coordinator.
Yes.
And then the coordinator crashes, so it could have been a commit before it crashed.
Yes. So you're asking this one extra step because we have one more state. Let's assume that everybody goes into pre-commit state. Okay? And then the coordinator crashes before you go ahead. Okay, what would you do? What does the pre-commit tell you? The pre-commit tells you that the coordinator, everybody voted to commit. The coordinator told at least one process that what the result of the vote was. That's why you went into pre-commit. Okay. So if some other process did not receive the results of a vote, coordinator crashes, it can just ask some process that's still alive saying what was the result of the vote, and then the process will say I'm in pre-commit state. So everybody is entered pre-commit. So it's safe to commit from a pre-commit state. If any one process enters pre-commit, it's safe for everyone to commit because you know that everybody voted to commit. That's the only way you could have gotten here in the state mission. Okay, is this clear? Any questions on this? It requires a little bit of understanding of what the protocol is and how it works, but I'm hoping that at least the intuition can what. Okay. So we have run out of time a little bit, but let me just talk about recovery and I'll stop here. We'll continue this next time. So The last part of fault tolerance is what happens during the recovery phase. Okay, so thus far we have just talked about how what happens during a failure and so on. Okay, but fault tolerance always has two aspects. One is to tolerate faults, and then when the fault is fixed, some process is going to recover. Okay, and the question is how do you let that process recover to a correct state? Okay, that part of the problem in fault tolerance is called recovery. In some sense, that process has to catch up with all the other processes. This is a replica. Okay, it has to catch up with the state of all of these other processes. So how do you go about doing that? Because it may be down for an arbitrary amount of time. Other replicas may have done, received other requests, done other computations and gone ahead. So when this process comes up, it is in some old, it has some old state of the system. Okay, it needs to talk to other replicas and catch up. So how do you do this? Okay, so we have looked at least one technique to do this. Okay, we have looked at this global state technique where you can do a keep doing checkpoints periodically using distributed snapshot algorithm. Okay, this is the checkpoint of the entire system. Okay, so if some process crashes and comes back up at a later point, you can just give it the most recent checkpoint that you have taken. And say this is the most recent state of the system. You can load that checkpoint and move from there. Okay, so in other words, everybody rolls back to the most recent checkpoint. Okay, and then you restart the computation from there. Okay, that's one way to do it. And we'll look at a second way which uses checkpoint and message logging. It says you checkpoint and then you also look at all the messages that were received after the checkpoint. Replay those messages to catch up to the most recent point, not to the most recent checkpoint, but to the most recent point in the computation. Okay. So we look at two techniques. One is how do you do the checkpointing and how do you do the message logging. Okay, that's what we'll hold off until next time to look at the details of this technique. Okay, so for today, let's just stop here.